The staff and volunteers of CJSF wish you a safe and happy holiday season.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! Russia continues its strikes on Ukraine as President Biden sends more military aid before Trump takes office next month. Meanwhile, Ukraine faces a cold, dark winter after Russian strikes destroyed about half of the country's energy infrastructure. We'll go to Kyiv to speak with leading Ukrainian human rights lawyer, Oleksandra Matveichuk. Then to Gaza, which is entering its second winter under attack from Israel, and talks to reach a ceasefire deal with Hamas appear to have stalled.
Due to the rain yesterday, water gathered over the worn-out tents and broke the wood. And water went down on those asleep, and we got up at 3 a.m. to try to gather what is left of the tent. This is our situation.
We'll get an update on the Gaza ceasefire talks with Gershon Baskin, a longtime Israeli-backed channel negotiator with Hamas, whose memoir is titled In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine. And as the sixth displaced Palestinian baby has died from hypothermia in Gaza, we'll speak with two doctors who worked in Gaza hospitals, including one who left just this week. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Amy Goodman will be back next year, that is, on Thursday. The United Nations warns Israeli attacks on hospitals have left Gaza's medical system on the brink of total collapse, with a catastrophic effect on Palestinians' access to health care. The new report by the UN Human Rights Office documents 136 Israeli attacks on 39 medical facilities. It was released just days after Israeli forces raided the Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza last Friday, destroying much of the facility and arresting staff and patients at gunpoint. There are growing calls internationally for Israel to release the hospital's director, Dr. Hossam Abu Safia, after he was abducted by Israeli forces and reportedly taken to a military detention camp with his leg badly injured. Amnesty International said on social media, quote, "Hospitals and health workers are not targets. The international community, especially Israel's allies, must act to bring an end to Israel's genocide against Palestinians in Gaza." This comes as at least seven Palestinians, including six babies living in displaced camps in Gaza, have died from the cold. And relentless winter rainstorms have flooded thousands of tents of forcibly displaced people. Sabreen Abu Shanab is a displaced mother of three, struggling to keep her family warm and fed in a tattered tent encampment in Deir al-Balah.
It rained, and although it was mild and not heavy rain, look what happened to us. We were flooded. The wooden poles of the tent broke, we barely fixed them. The water seeped inside and into the mattresses and my children's clothes. They were sleeping and soaked wet to their underwear. I swear, everything is soaked, the blankets, the pillows, everything.
Israel's military says it intercepted a missile fired toward Tel Aviv by Yemen's Houthis late on Monday. The missile triggered air raid sirens and halted takeoffs and landings at Ben Gurion Airport for about an hour. It was the fifth such attack by Houthis over the past week, coming just days after Israel bombed the Yemeni port city of Hodeidah and the capital Sana'a, killing at least six people and injuring dozens. Among those who narrowly survived the attack on Sana'a was Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, head of the World Health Organization, who was just meters away from a blast from an Israeli bomb dropped on the airport. On Monday, Dr. Tedros called on both the Houthis and the Israelis to stop their attacks.
The attack inflicted needless death, injury, panic, chaos, and damage, and was another reminder of the growing threat faced by civilians, humanitarians, and health workers in war zones around the world. This must stop.
On Monday, Israel's ambassador to the United Nations delivered what he called a final warning to Yemen's Houthis, saying they could soon, quote, share the same miserable fate as Hamas in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Bashar al-Assad in Syria. France's defense ministry says its warplanes bombed Islamic State positions in central Syria on Sunday. The French attacks follow several U.S. strikes on IS positions following the ouster of longtime dictator Bashar al-Assad in early December. In related news, Syria's new foreign minister has held his first diplomatic meetings. Assad Hassan al-Shibani was named Syria's top diplomat on December 21st by the interim government. On Monday, he welcomed Kuwait's foreign minister for talks about ending international sanctions and pledging closer ties to countries of the Gulf Cooperation Council. Al-Shibani also met with Ukraine's foreign minister to discuss strengthening ties after decades of Russian support for Bashar al-Assad's rule.
There will be strategic contributions and partnerships between us and Ukraine on political, economic, and social levels. We also have scientific collaborations that we will restart with Ukraine. We once again welcome the Ukrainian foreign minister.
The Syrian and Ukrainian diplomats also discussed the fate of a Russian naval base and airbase in Syria, Russia's only two military bases outside of the former Soviet Union. Russia and Ukraine have completed a prisoner swap, repatriating more than 300 prisoners of war in a deal brokered by the United Arab Emirates ahead of the start of the new year. On the Ukrainian side, the swap included some prisoners who'd been held for over 2 years, including soldiers who defended Snake Island in the Black Sea and others who held out for months defending the southern city of Mariupol from Russia's invasion.
My son is 5 years old now. The last time I saw him, he was 2 years old. That's why my son probably didn't recognize me. I used to have a beard and hair. He was 2 years old. I lost 44 pounds.
Ukrainian officials say Moscow has released nearly 4,000 soldiers and civilians in deals with Kyiv since Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. Meanwhile, President Biden on Monday announced another $2.5 billion in U.S. military aid to Ukraine. The package includes air defense missiles, munitions for rocket and artillery systems, anti-tank weapons, and more. Separately, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen announced $3.4 billion in economic assistance to Ukraine. Since Russia's invasion nearly 3 years ago, Congress has approved $175 billion in total assistance to Ukraine. Biden is rushing aid before President-elect Trump takes office in 3 weeks. On the campaign trail, Trump expressed skepticism about sending more aid and repeatedly pledged to end the war in his first 24 hours in office. In Kenya, police in Nairobi on Monday fired tear gas at protesters demanding the release of dozens of government critics who've been abducted by armed groups in recent months. Protesters blame Kenya's police and intelligence service for the disappearances. Human rights groups have condemned the extrajudicial arrests carried out as Kenyan President William Ruto cracks down on nationwide anti-government protests. Ruto previously called the disappearances, quote, fake news. Over 50 anti-abduction protesters were arrested Monday, including opposition lawmaker Okiye Omtatah. The Pentagon has repatriated one of the first Guantanamo Bay prisoners to Tunisia after more than 2 decades of incarceration without trial. Rida bin Saleh al-Yazidi had been held at the notorious U.S. military prison in Cuba since it opened in 2002. He was abducted by Pakistani soldiers near the Afghan border in 2001 and accused of being an al-Qaeda fighter, but was never charged with a crime. Al-Yazidi was cleared for release more than a decade ago. 26 prisoners remain at Guantanamo Bay 16 years after Barack Obama pledged to close the prison in his first year as president. A federal appeals court has rejected President-elect Trump's attempt to overturn a 2023 jury verdict that found him liable for sexually abusing writer E. Jean Carroll and then defaming her as Trump repeatedly denied the accusations. At the time, a jury awarded Carroll $5 million in compensatory and punitive damages. Carroll accused Trump of raping her in the dressing room of a Bergdorf Goodman department store in Manhattan in the mid-1990s. Trump has continued his attacks on Carroll, recently reposting a photo of Carroll on his Truth Social media platform with the caption, quote, "Should a woman go to jail for falsely accusing a man of rape?" Afghanistan's Taliban leaders have announced the closure of all national and international NGOs that currently employ women. The latest crackdown comes 2 years after Taliban officials issued a rule that banned Afghan women from working at NGOs, including humanitarian relief agencies, under the threat of losing their license. This also comes as the Taliban has prohibited the construction of new residential buildings with windows that overlook areas where women might be sitting or standing. Taliban officials also said existing windows with such views should be blocked. A Taliban government spokesperson said in a statement, quote, "Seeing women working in kitchens, in courtyards, or collecting water from wells can lead to obscene acts." And press freedom groups are demanding that Iran release Italian journalist Cecilia Sala, who was arrested in Tehran on December 19th and has since been held in solitary confinement inside Tehran's Evin prison. Sala, who works for the newspaper Il Foglio and an Italian podcast company, had entered Iran on a regular journalist visa. Just days before her arrest, she filed this report from Tehran.
Sono tornata in Iran, il posto dove più volevo tornare.
I have returned to Iran, the place I most wanted to come back to. Since the last time I was here, many things have changed. One is that hundreds of thousands of women no longer wear the veil, or at least not in the way the law dictates. And they are not afraid of foreigner like me taking their picture of the Chinese-made smart cameras scattered throughout the city, scanning their faces or sending alerts to the police.
Iranian authorities have for the first time confirmed the arrest of Cecilia Sala amid signs they may be angling for a prisoner swap. A day before Sala's arrest, police in Italy detained a 38-year-old Iranian man accused of working with Iran's Revolutionary Guards for possible extradition to the United States. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Amy Goodman will be back Thursday. We begin today's show in Ukraine, where Russia has launched multiple missile and drone attacks today on the capital Kyiv and other regions. Ukraine is already facing a cold, dark winter after Russian strikes destroyed about half of the country's energy infrastructure. On Monday, President Biden said the United States will send nearly $2.5 billion more in weapons to Ukraine before President-elect Donald Trump returns to office in a few weeks. The package includes air defense missiles, munitions for rocket and artillery systems, anti-tank weapons, and more. Separately, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen announced $3.4 billion in economic assistance to Ukraine. Since Russia's invasion nearly 3 years ago, Congress has approved $175 billion in total assistance to Ukraine. Biden is rushing aid before President-elect Trump takes office in 3 weeks. On the campaign trail, Trump expressed skepticism about sending more aid and repeatedly pledged to end the war in his first 24 hours in office. This comes as Russia and Ukraine have completed a prisoner swap, repatriating more than 300 prisoners of war in a deal brokered by the United Arab Emirates ahead of the new year. On the Ukrainian side, the swap included some prisoners who'd been held for over 2 years, including soldiers who defended Snake Island in the Black Sea and others who held out for months defending the southern city of Mariupol from Russia's invasion.
My son is 5 years old now. The last time I saw him, he was 2 years old. That's why my son probably didn't recognize me. I used to have a beard and hair. He was 2 years old. I lost 44 pounds.
Meanwhile, today marks 25 years since Russian President Vladimir Putin became president of Russia. For more, we're joined in Kyiv by Oleksandra Medvedchuk, leading Ukrainian human rights lawyer. She's worked with the Tribunal for Putin Initiative to document over 80,000 war crimes committed by Russia since its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. She leads the human rights organization Center for Civil Liberties, which was awarded the 2022 Nobel Peace Prize. In the same year, she received the Right Livelihood Award. Her recent piece for The Hill is headlined, Ukraine faces a cold, dark winter after Russia's energy strikes. Oleksandra, welcome back to Democracy Now! We're speaking to you in Kyiv. Could you describe what the situation there is on the ground as the capital city of Ukraine comes under attack from Russia?
This night we have the next rockets and drone attack to Kyiv and to other cities and settlements in the country. And this has become quite regular phenomena. Russia want to destroy completely Ukraine energy system and to make millions of Ukrainians to face the winter without heating, electricity, water, light, and internet connection. But what I want to say that due to the work of ordinary people who repair this civil infrastructure, we are able to meet this new year Eve with light. And this is a bright symbol of Ukrainian resilience.
And could you explain, Oleksandra, your organization has been documenting war crimes. You're working with this tribunal on Putin to document war crimes, 80,000. I mean, if you could just give a sense of what kinds of crimes have been occurring in Ukraine for the last almost 3 years since Russia's invasion.
I'm a human rights lawyer, which means that I apply in the law to defend people and human dignity for many years. But now I found myself in a situation when the law doesn't work. What we document? We document how Russian troops destroying residential buildings, schools, churches, museums and hospitals. They're taking evacuation corridors. They're torturing people in filtration camps. They're forcibly taking Ukrainian children to Russia. They're abducting, robbing, raping, and killing civilians in the occupied territories. And the entire UN system of peace and security can't stop it. Russia uses war crimes as the methods of warfare. Russia instrumentalized the pain. Russia used the pain as a tool how to break people's resistance and to occupy the country.
Oleksandra, you know, we last spoke to you, in fact, just days after the invasion in February 2022. I mean, conditions have been so brutal. You're in Kyiv, which has come under constant attack. Explain why you made the decision to stay in Kyiv all this time and how you and those who you know in the city have coped with the power blackouts and other things that have happened. As Russia has continued its assault?
I decided to stay because this is my home. This is my country. This is my family. And we will fight for our freedom and for our human dignity. I remember this time very clearly because not just Putin, but also our international partners were confident that Ukraine has no potential to resist to such enormous opposing power. And I remember how even international organizations evacuated their personnel, but ordinary people remained, and ordinary people started to do extraordinary things. It were ordinary people who helped to survive under artillery fires. It were ordinary people who took people out from the ruined cities. It were ordinary people who broke through the encirclement to provide humanitarian aid. And you know what? Suddenly, it became obvious that ordinary people fighting for their freedom and human dignity are stronger than even the second army in the world.
Well, let's talk, Alexandra, about what you think the prospects are for some kind of a peace or ceasefire deal. Moscow has recently rejected a peace plan by U.S. President-elect Trump to end the war, which proposed delaying Kyiv's NATO membership in exchange for a ceasefire. This is Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov speaking last week.
We cannot be satisfied with empty talk. So far, all we hear is talk about the need to come up with some kind of truce, and it is not particularly hidden that this truce is needed in order to gain time to continue pumping Ukraine with weapons so that they can get themselves in order, carry out additional mobilization, and so on. A truce is a road to nowhere. We need final legal agreements that will fix all the conditions for ensuring the security of the Russian Federation and, of course, the legitimate security interests of our neighbors, but in the context that will secure the impossibility of violating these agreements in an internationally legal manner.
So that's Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Alexandra, if you could respond to what he said and what Ukraine's demands are, what do you expect might happen once Trump comes into office in just a few weeks? And do you think Ukraine should be making concessions? And if so, what concessions?
I'm not surprised with this response from Russia because Putin doesn't want peace. Putin started this war not just to capture one more piece of Ukrainian land. Putin started this war to occupy and to destroy the whole Ukraine and to go further, to attack next countries and to forcibly restore Russian Empire. And the problem is that after 2.5 years of large-scale invasion, Putin didn't refuse from this goal. Because human life is the cheapest resources in Russian state. And we have to take this goal seriously in all our strategies and all our visions how to stop Russian war of aggression against Ukraine. And this means that we have to design a real security guarantees which make Putin's goal not just to postpone it in time, but make it impossible for Putin to achieve. And this is important because people in Ukraine want peace much more than anyone else because the war is horrible. But peace doesn't come when country which was invaded stop resisting to Russian aggression. That's not peace. That's occupation. And occupation is horrible. It's just the same war, but in another form, because Russian occupation means torture, rapes, enforced disappearances, denial of your own identity, forcible adoption of your children, filtration camps and mass graves. And that's why we have no other choice. Because if we stop resisting to Russian aggression, it will be no more us.
And what do you expect with Trump coming into office in a few weeks? What changes in U.S. policy do you anticipate? And do you think that Trump being in office may force Ukraine to give up territory in exchange for a peace deal with Russia? Trump has said he would end the war within 24 hours of coming into office.
It's very difficult for me to predict the policy of next president administration. I hope that Trump will use this famous Reagan principle to the peace through strength. And once again, we have to take the real goal of Russia seriously. Putin doesn't want some more part of Ukrainian Donbas. Putin wants to achieve his historical goal. To forcibly restore Russian Empire. He think about his legacy. So it's not about territories at all. But for us, for Ukrainians, it's also not just about territories because we are fighting for people who live there. It's our people. It's our relatives. It's our families. It's our citizens. We can't leave them alone for torture and death under Russian occupation. We have no moral rights. We have to return the human dimension of this war when we're discussing these difficult geopolitical issues.
And Alexandra, what about the role of the European Union, the key countries in the European, France, Germany, their role in pushing for a ceasefire and also the amount of aid that they've been giving to Ukraine, whether you think that's adequate and what you anticipate happening in the future as the EU also cuts back on aid?
It's very difficult for me to provide expertise on the military assistance because I'm not a military expert. But what I see, because I oftenly travel not just to Washington, but to Berlin, to Paris, to Rome, to Brussels, I see that politicians in the European Union started to understand that their countries are safe only because Ukrainians still fighting. I see this even in our human rights work. What do I mean? Russia is empire, and empire has a center, but has no borders. And empire always try to expand. And when I interviewed people who survived Russian captivity, they told me that Russians see their future like this, that first we'll occupy Ukraine, and then, together with you, we will go to conquer in other countries. And the process of forcible mobilization, Ukrainian citizens to Russian army, all these years is going on in the occupied territories. So once again, people in European Union are safe only because Ukrainians are still fighting with Russian aggression and don't let Putin to go further.
And I want to go back to something that we mentioned earlier, which is this prisoner swap that's just taken place. Russia and Ukraine have swapped more than 300 prisoners of war in a mass exchange brokered by the United Arab Emirates. If you could comment on what you think the significance of this is and what's known about the Ukrainians who remain in Russian captivity, including civilians, and then also address Russia's targeting of journalists. One case is Ukrainian journalist Victoria Roschaya, who died in Russian detention earlier this year.
I work with the topic of illegally detained civilians and prisoners of the war for 10 years. I personally interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people who survived in Russian captivity, and they told me how they were beaten, raped, smashed into wooden boxes, their fingers were cut, their nails were turned away, their nails were drilled, they were electrically shocked through their own genitalia. One woman told me how her eye was dug out with a spoon, because Russia ignored not just all provisions of international humanitarian law, Russia ignored all senses of humanity. So that's why yesterday, prisoner swap, it was so important for all people in Ukraine, because we released more than 180 people who will celebrate this holiday with their families. And this is extremely important, as well as thousands and thousands of prisoners of the war and illegally detained civilians. Among them, a lot of women are still in Russian captivity. And let me tell a little bit about my friend and colleague Victoria Roschina, which you mentioned. She was a Ukrainian journalist, extremely brave. She worked in occupied territories because she thought that this is her journalist obligation to be there with the people who were alone with the occupiers. She was just 27 years old, and she died in September in Russian prison after illegally arrest. And Russians for several times refused to return her body to her family, because her body probably can tell more about what happened with her, why she was dead. And I ask myself, if we can't press Russia to return the dead body of Ukrainian journalist to her family as international community, how we can to protect freedom of speech in the world at all?
And Alexandra, finally, today marks 25 years since Putin has been president of Russia. Your reflections on that, and of course, this is the last day of the year, 2024. What do you hope will happen next year in 2025? You wrote in your recent piece in The Hill, despite these horrific war crimes, the spirit of the Ukrainian people is unbroken.
Let me quote my Russian human rights colleagues. They told that Putin, he's a big ear. He hears what Russians want, and he tried to implement it with this war to restore the force of this Russian empire forcibly and to demonstrate Russian people's so-called Russian glory. And that is why the democratic